welcome to this month's Astropod. I'm Lauren Weiss.
And I'm Maciek Hermanowicz.
So, Maciek, I've heard that Martin Rees, one of the astronomers here at Cambridge, has just won a very prestigious prize.
Indeed, he was awarded the Templeton Prize, which is a prize designed to honor a living person who has made exceptional contributions to affirming life's spiritual dimension. Now, for those of you, dear listeners, who don't know it, Martin Rees is one of the most eminent figures at the Institute of Astronomy here in Cambridge. He's one of the previous heads of the department. He's the current Astronomer Royal, as well as the current President of the Royal Society, and the Master of Trinity College here in Cambridge.
And now, let's turn it over to the news.
Hi, I'm Laura, and welcome to this month's Astro News. Interacting sunspots produce giant solar flare. Interactions between five rotating sunspots have spawned the largest solar flare recorded in 5 years. The sunspots and the flare were observed by the Solar Dynamics Observatory on February 15th this year. This is the first flare of the current solar cycle to be classified as the most powerful X-class. Sunspots are formed when the sun's magnetic field, generated deep in the star, pushes through the sun's surface and into its atmosphere. This twisting of the solar magnetic field is a bit like twisting an elastic band. At first, energy is stored in the elastic band, but if you twist too much, then the band snaps. Rotating sunspots store energy, but if they twist too much, the magnetic field breaks free, releasing a solar flare. Kepler discovers unusual triplets. The Kepler satellite has discovered an unusual system, HD181068, consisting of a red giant star orbited by two smaller red dwarf stars. The red giant is more than 12 times the Sun's diameter, and the two red dwarf stars are each slightly smaller than the Sun. The red dwarfs orbit each other in a close orbit, and the pair then circles the red giant every 45.5 days, causing an eclipse seen by Kepler. The system, lying 800 light-years from Earth, is also unusually quiet. This means that the red giant doesn't exhibit the typical seismic oscillations that most stars undergo. Astronomers speculate that the red dwarfs may be creating some sort of gravitational offset that effectively negates the red giant's vibrations, but further investigation is needed to confirm this. New mineral from an old meteorite. NASA scientists studying the meteorite Yamato 691, an enstatite chondrite found in Antarctica in 1969, have discovered a brand new mineral. The meteorite probably came from the asteroid belt between Mars and Jupiter, and is about 4.5 billion years old, close to the age of the solar system. The new mineral, basanite, is formed from only two elements, sulfur and titanium, and has a crystal structure that's never been seen before. The amount of basanite in this rock is tiny, less than 1/100th the width of a human hair. Meteorites such as these provide fascinating insight into the conditions and processes occurring when the solar system was just forming. Pluto has more atmosphere. A team of astronomers from St Andrews University have discovered carbon monoxide in the atmosphere of Pluto. Pluto was downgraded in 2006 to a dwarf planet, one of the handful of such bodies with sizes of hundreds of kilometres that orbit in the distant reaches of the solar system, out beyond Neptune. Pluto is the only dwarf planet known to have an atmosphere, found in 1988 when it dimmed the light of a distant star before Pluto passed in front of it. The new results, obtained at the 15-metre James Clerk Maxwell Telescope in Hawaii, show a strong signal of carbon monoxide gas. Previously, the atmosphere was known to be over 100 kilometres thick, but the new data raises this height to more than 3,000 kilometres, a quarter of the way out to Pluto's largest moon, Charon. This great height makes the atmosphere very fragile, with its top layers being blown into space. Carbon monoxide is probably produced by evaporation of surface ice by the sun, and is thought to be just a trace element in the larger nitrogen atmosphere. It acts like a coolant in the atmosphere, and could even cause the nitrogen to freeze out into nitrogen snow. In 2025, the NASA New Horizons probe is due to fly by Pluto and should provide a fascinating insight into this cold atmosphere. That's all for this month's Astro News.
Thank you very much, Laura.
So, Maciek, did you know that a new near-Earth asteroid has been discovered?
No, I have to say that slipped under my screen. What is this one?
Don't worry, when I say near-Earth asteroid, it's 50 times as far away from us as the moon is. And it turns out this asteroid is in no danger of hitting us because it is in what we call a stable horseshoe orbit around the Earth.
So, what do you mean by a horseshoe orbit?
So if you picture the moon, which goes all the way around the Earth once a month, yes. This asteroid, which is, of course, quite a bit farther out, goes around but doesn't ever quite make it all the way around the Earth before it turns around and goes back the other way in sort of a horseshoe shape about the Earth. And this happens while the Earth and the asteroid and the moon together are all revolving around the Sun. So it turns out it takes this asteroid 175 years to make it from one end of its horseshoe orbit to the other.
That is quite a long time. I would find it quite surprising.
Right, and that's why we haven't discovered it until now, actually, because it has just come to a part in its orbit where it is more visible to astronomers on Earth. But it turns out this asteroid, which is actually quite large, scientists estimate that its diameter is 200 to 400 meters, which would make it the largest asteroid in this sort of horseshoe orbit. There's a population of asteroids around Earth, small ones, much smaller than this, that have a similar orbit.
So have we discovered some of those before?
Yes, we have.
Ah, okay.
But this is the biggest. But it turns out that this one is probably about 250,000 years old, and scientists know this from doing computer simulations of its stability.
250,000 years old, as in it has been in the orbit for the 250,000 years,
right,
as opposed
that's
to the,
right,
the
that's
block
right.
of rock.
Exactly. So
young.
The lump of rock is probably older, but the asteroid has been in this orbit for 250,000 years. And there are a few theories about how it got there, one of which is that it might have come from a population of asteroids between Mars and Jupiter called the asteroid belt. However, this theory is considered rather unlikely at the moment because there would have to be a lot of sort of very special circumstances mm-hmm. for it to get into this horseshoe orbit around Earth. Another idea is that it might be a remnant from the formation of the moon, but this is also considered unlikely because of the stability of the asteroid.
Well, so, given that horseshoes are supposed to bring you luck, I wouldn't put a lucky fluke completely out of the window.
Well, there's one other interesting idea about where this asteroid might come from, which is that there is a population of asteroids 60 degrees away from the Earth in orbit around the Sun. So there's
something
the Earth
like the...
and then a group of asteroids 60 degrees in front and 60 degrees behind.
So essentially it would be the equivalent of the Trojan asteroids.
The Trojan, exactly, just like the Trojan asteroids in Jupiter's orbit. So it's possible that the asteroid has come from there, but further research about the color of the asteroid and its orbital parameters will help solve this mysterious new object.
Ah, fair enough. That's quite exciting. And now I believe it's time for Alex with the history section.
Hello everyone, and welcome to this month's AstroPod history section. In this month's edition, we hear from Cambridge physicist Dr. Jonathan Gehr about his work on gravitational waves. As you may know, these are a prediction of Albert Einstein's theory of general relativity. So this month, we'll be taking a brief look at Einstein's life and career, perhaps the most influential career of any scientist before or since. Einstein was born in Ulm in southern Germany in 1879 to Jewish parents and was exposed to classical texts in philosophy and mathematics from a young age. Throughout his youth, Albert displayed a genuine academic creativity with particular excellence in maths and physics, subjects he would later study at university in Zurich. It would seem that Einstein's relationship with his father had a significant impact on his later work as an academic. Hermann Einstein was an electrical engineer and encouraged his son to study magnetism and electricity. Albert found the study of engineering tedious, but frequent experiments with magnets and circuits provided the seeds for his groundbreaking work on special relativity several years later. Einstein met his future wife, Mileva Maric, in 1896 at the Polytechnic, and upon graduation he was found work at a patent office in Bern, evaluating patents for electromagnetic devices. His 2 years at the office provided Einstein with more thought experiments on electromagnetism, and it was during this time that he was introduced to the philosophy of Poincaré, Mach, and Hume, who would all greatly influence Einstein in his later work. While in Switzerland, Einstein published important work on the physics of capillary action and molecular motion in fluids, and was awarded a PhD from the University of Zurich in 1905. This year would prove to be his annus mirabilis, as he published 4 landmark papers on the random motion of small particles, the photoelectric effect, the equivalence of mass and energy, and his theory of special relativity. All four of these papers would kickstart revolutions in 20th century theoretical physics. His work on Brownian motion gave birth to a resurgence in statistical mechanics. His treatise on the photoelectric effect contributed to the foundation of quantum theory in the 1920s and 30s, ultimately leading to the most accurate theory humans have ever produced in the shape of quantum electrodynamics. His special theory of relativity naturally explained the connection of the speed of light to electromagnetism, and held that space and time are not absolute concepts. His famous equation E equals mc squared was also derived this year. Over the next few years, Einstein formulated his general theory of relativity, which incorporated gravity into his special theory of relativity. One of the key predictions of this was that light from distant stars would be bent by the gravity of the sun by twice as much as predicted by Newtonian physics. In 1919, this exact effect was observed during a solar eclipse on the island of Principe by Arthur Eddington, and Einstein soon became an international superstar. On the 7th of November that year, the Times printed the headline, "Revolution in Science, New Theory of the Universe, Newtonian Ideas Overthrown." 2 years later, Einstein received the Nobel Prize for Physics. During the 1920s, Einstein toured Europe and the world, giving invited lectures and public talks, and was treated like a head of state wherever he went. He emigrated to the United States in 1933 due to the rise of Hitler. Being the world's foremost Jewish intellectual had put a $5,000 bounty on his head. Albert took up tenure at the Princeton's Institute of Advanced Study, working alongside the great Kurt Gödel. The most infamous moment of Einstein's life came in 1939. Upon learning of the Nazi atomic bomb program, Einstein co-wrote a letter with Leo Szilard to President Franklin Roosevelt, warning of its potential dangers and explicitly recommending the creation of a rival American nuclear weapons program. The letter is considered to be responsible for the birth of the Manhattan Project and of the nuclear age. The greater danger of the Nazis getting there first provided Einstein his justification, but he remained regretful of his decision to participate in writing. During the later years of his life, Einstein worked on the foundations of quantum mechanics, a theory he had helped to create and which was by now fully fledged. His correspondence with the Danish physicist Niels Bohr and his collaboration with Podolsky and Rosen threw light on inherent paradoxes in the new theory. Einstein died in 1955 at his beloved Princeton, aged 76. His legacy cannot be overstated. There has never been a scientist who has had such an impact on such a broad range of subjects, and his love of art and philosophy serve as a model for physicists everywhere.
This month, our guest is Dr. Jonathan Geir from the Institute of Astronomy. It's a pleasure to have you on the show.
Thank you.
So your research is dealing with the field that many call the astronomy of the future or astronomy of tomorrow, which is the gravitational waves. Could you tell our listeners a little bit about the basic concepts of this field?
Of course. So gravitational waves are one of the predictions of Einstein's theory of relativity. Just as the fact that light travels at a finite speed leads to electromagnetic radiation, one of the main things that Einstein contributed to our understanding of gravity was the fact that gravity also travels at finite speed. And this means that if you have changes in distribution of mass in one part of space, this takes a while for the information about those changes to propagate elsewhere in the universe. And these propagating fluctuations in gravity are what we call gravitational waves. We believe they should travel at the speed of light. That's one of the things we hope to test with our future observations. The main problem with detection of gravitational waves is that they're very weak, much weaker than electromagnetic radiation, and so you need very energetic sources to produce gravitational waves of sufficient magnitude that we can detect them. So typical things will be mergers between binary black holes. We think that when some stars of sufficiently high mass reach the end of their normal lives, they'll collapse and leave black hole remnants that have masses of a few to maybe 10 or 20 solar masses. And if these things are in binaries, then over a period of time, the orbit decays and eventually these things merge with one another. And in those final few hundred orbits, they'll be producing gravitational waves at levels that we hope to be able to detect using some ground-based detectors. We also have good evidence that in the centers of most galaxies, there are much more massive black holes. These things may have formed in the early universe and grown over time through accretion of gas. And these things can have masses anywhere from 10,000 times the mass of our sun to several billion times the mass of the sun. When galaxies merge, these black holes, which are in their centers, will eventually merge, or that's what we believe. And when this happens, it also produces very large amounts of gravitational radiation. The frequency scales like 1 over the mass, because larger systems, so more massive systems are larger, so the typical time it takes for orbits is longer, and hence the frequency of the radiation you produce is lower. And so we actually need different detectors to detect these much more massive systems than for the systems that are comparable to the mass of the sun.
So those detectors would be something like the LISA mission, which is currently in planning, isn't it?
That is correct. So we have two types of detector, either being constructed or planned. On the ground, we have something called LIGO, which is a US collaboration primarily, but there's also a detector called Virgo, which is a French-Italian collaboration, something called GEO, which is UK-German collaboration. There is also an Australian project, which is quite small, called IGO, and a Japanese project called TAMA. So each of these detectors is ground-based, and the frequencies to which they're sensitive are typically around a few tens to about 1,000 hertz, so hertz is and one oscillation per second. And these are the detectors which we hope to see detect sources which have roughly solar masses.
How do those detectors work? What's the principle of operations?
So the way the detector works is to exploit one of the properties of a gravitational wave. So when a gravitational wave propagates through space, what it actually does is stretch and squeeze space-time. This means that objects become either closer together or further apart. But the effect of a gravitational wave actually is opposite in directions that are perpendicular to one another, and also perpendicular to the line of travel. So although it's very difficult to measure an absolute distance between two objects, it is much easier to measure relative distances. And so since one direction is being stretched while another is being squeezed, what you can do is measure the relative difference between two directions at right angles, and that's how you can detect a gravitational wave. To do this, we use light. If you take a single beam of light and split it up into two beams that you then send in these two directions at right angles, you reflect it off an object at the other end that's in freefall, and then recombine the light back at the source. In the absence of a gravitational wave, these two light beams travel the same distance, and so it takes the same time, and that means when the light returns to the observer, it's in phase in the two arms, and so you don't see any difference. If a gravitational wave passes through the detector, one arm becomes longer while the other arm becomes shorter, and so the light takes different amounts of time to come back to the source, and so you see a phase difference. And it's this phase difference that our detectors try and measure.
Excellent. So is the same principle applied in the LISA project, in the space-based detector?
It is. So the main difference between the ground-based detectors and the space-based detector is the size. In space, you are much less constrained, and so you can have much bigger detectors. That makes things more sensitive, because a gravitational wave has something called a strain associated with it, which is a fractional change in length. So the absolute difference in the lengths that you're measuring becomes bigger if you have longer arms. And so in sense, longer arms are better. But and so in space, we have, the proposal for LISA is 5 million kilometers between the satellites which form the ends of the interferometer. The longer arms also affect your frequency sensitivity, because if your gravitational wave completes a full oscillation during the time it takes the light to travel along your arm, you don't see any effect, because although one arm is initially stretched, and the second half of the cycle it's being squeezed, and so if the light takes too long to propagate, you actually, these effects cancel out and you don't see anything. So that's why LISA is sensitive to different masses than the ground-based detectors. LISA is much bigger, so it's sensitive to lower frequencies, and that's why we hope to be able to see these very massive black holes that are in the centers of galaxies with LISA. LIGO, which is the ground-based detector, is sensitive to lighter black holes, which have masses a few times the mass of our Sun, and it's this that we hope to see mergers between such systems that form from stars.
Right. Given that the first detection of gravitational waves, the first direct detection, is yet to be made, would you say you think of yourself more as a theoretician or an observational astronomer?
So I would regard myself as very much a theorist at the moment. Hopefully I'll become an observational gravitational wave astronomer at some point during my career. There are a lot of people who would probably describe themselves as experimentalists. The LIGO detectors exist, and they have been taking data for nearly a decade now. But a lot of that initial work has been to make sure the technology works, to isolate sources of noise in the detector and do our best to mitigate them. And this is quite a lot of work from people working on the experiments. There has been a big data analysis effort. So far, LIGO has not announced any detections of gravitational waves, but the data that has been taken has allowed them to set upper limits. The main problem for all of these detectors is the rate at which these sources occur in the universe. So as we haven't observed any of the systems yet, we can't say how often mergers will take place. Now, we have other constraints on the number and distribution of masses of stars. That tells us approximately how many stellar mass black holes might exist and how many of them might be in binaries. And from that, we can infer how often we think these mergers will take place. But until LIGO actually starts seeing these things, we're not going to be able to constrain this.
What's
very
the
well.
Best guess at the moment?
So the best guess of the rate of events is of the order of one a year within about 50 megaparsecs of the Earth. Now, the current LIGO sensitivity is to a distance of a few tens of megaparsec, so we're at the point where the best guess for the rates could have given us one event in a year, but it hasn't. But the detectors are being upgraded now, which will give them a factor of 5 or so improvement in sensitivity, and the sensitivity translates directly into the distance to which you can see a source. So we expect to get about a factor of 5 improvement in distance, which means a factor of about 100 or more in the volume of space to which we're sensitive. And so we should go from of the order of 1 per year to the order of 100 per year. Now, there are still great uncertainties in these rates. So 100 per year may mean 10 per year. It could mean as little as 1 per year, which would obviously be disappointing because we're not going to be able to learn that much from our detectors if that's the case. But we still have 2 orders of magnitude to play with.
Indeed. What would you say is your gut feeling for when we will be able to observe the first signature of gravitational waves? I mean, I know it will be a wild guess, but what do you hope
for? We already have observed the first signatures of gravitational waves because we can infer their existence indirectly from other observations. We can observe binary stars, which the orbit is decaying because they're emitting gravitational radiation. We have 2 systems in which this has been observed, and the predictions of relativity have shown to be absolutely correct. Now, that is probably considered an indirect detection of gravitational waves, but it's part of what gives us confidence that Einstein's theory is correct, and so we're not searching for something that doesn't exist. In terms of when we'll make the first direct detection, I'd say the most likely time would be sometime around 2016. The upgrade to the LIGO detectors is going to take a few years, They should be commissioning from sometime around 2014 to 2015, and it'll take a while then to collect some data. But assuming everything goes to plan, they may make the first detection sometime in 2016. There is another project that's ongoing, which theoretically could announce the first detection before LIGO. That there are things called pulsars, which are rapidly rotating neutron stars, and because these rotate at a constant rate, and they produce pulses of radiation whenever the neutron star jet points towards us, you can use them as very accurate clocks. So you can actually use a pulsar effectively as one arm of your detector. If you time the pulse arrival at the Earth, and a gravitational wave passes between you and the pulsar, because distance is stretched or squeezed, the pulses either arrive slightly earlier than you expect them to, or slightly later. And this is another way that we can infer the presence of gravitational waves. Whether you call this a direct observation or an indirect observation is up to you. But there is now a big effort to time networks of pulsars. Obviously, having a detection from multiple pulsars is a much stronger case than from a single pulsar. So they're timing pulsars that are particularly good in the sense that their rotation periods appear to be very stable, because that's what we need. If the period changes a lot, then we don't know that any deviations we see are arising from intrinsic changes in the neutron star or from the presence of a gravitational wave. But we know of about order 10 of these pulsars, which are currently being timed carefully, and it's possible that they'll actually lead to the first indirect evidence. Well, sorry, the first sort of direct evidence for the existence of gravitational waves within, again, a 5-year time frame.
It looks like we have a very exciting time in front of us then.
It does.
Right, thank you very much. It was a pleasure to have you as our guest this month. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you, Jonathan and Maciek.
Lauren, did you know that the Chinese have just finished the phase one of their lunar exploration program?
No, I didn't even know they were exploring the moon.
Yeah, I have to say that it's a bit hard to find the public releases on those missions, but apparently the Chang'e 2 orbiter, which is the second, in fact, it's the second Chinese mission to the moon, has just been announced to finish its primary mission with a success, and now they're ready to move on to the phase 2, which means sending two rovers onto the surface of the moon within the next few years. And so the main purpose of the current mission was to identify a few of the viable landing sites for the rovers. And then in 2017, they plan to move on to phase 3, which is an automated sample return mission.
How cool. So China has orbited the moon, but they haven't landed the moon or put anything on the moon yet, right?
Not just yet. Well, they haven't put anything on the moon in a gentle way yet, because what happened to the first orbiter, the Chang'e 1, after it has served through its mission as the scientific orbiter imaging the moon, they use it as an impactor, essentially ramming it into the surface to observe the properties of the impact zone afterwards, because that gives you a few of the informations of how hard the lunar surfaces. And now it's time for Alex with the Sky at Night.
Up in the skies this month, the star T Pixidis is currently undergoing a long-awaited outburst in the south-southwest just after dark, east of the constellation Canis Major. It is a recurrent nova, meaning that it periodically flares up to be much brighter than usual. The last time this was observed was in December 1966, and the longest gap between flares before then was only 24 years, so this outburst has been very long overdue. If it follows the brightness pattern of the last outburst, then the brightness should peak on May the 20th, when it will be visible to the naked eye if you have a very dark sky. It is actually a binary system with a white dwarf accreting mass off its partner, and so it's likely to explode in a supernova sometime in the next 10 million years, although since it's at a distance of 3,000 light-years away, the explosion shouldn't cause us any problems here on Earth. Following on from the Lyrids, this month's meteor shower is the Eta Aquarids, visible in the early hours of May the 6th, and seeming to radiate from the constellation Aquarius in the east. With moonlight not a problem this year, the predicted observed rate is about 20 to 40 meteors per hour if you have nice dark skies. Meteor showers are caused when the Earth passes through the debris trail of a comet, and these meteors are all debris from one of the most famous, Halley's Comet. Mercury, Jupiter, Mars, Venus, and Uranus are all very difficult to spot in the glow of dawn, but if you fancy a challenge, then look very close to the eastern horizon about half an hour before sunrise. Venus is the clearest to see at the beginning of the month. However, as the month goes on, Jupiter will rise higher and become a little brighter. Mars is very close to Jupiter at the beginning of the month, although since it's much smaller and dimmer, it will be a challenge. The best planet to see all month is Saturn, rising in the southeast as darkness falls and nice and bright in the south-southwest around midnight. The rings are relatively clear at 8 degrees from edge on, and the bright white spot that appeared in December last year has all but faded away into a hardly noticeable pale band. Finally, this is a heads up for any listeners who may be in some of the extreme northern locations of the globe on the 1st of June, when a partial solar eclipse crosses over Siberia, northern Canada, and Greenland. From the North Pole, about a third of the sun will be covered at mid-eclipse, which is at 9:17 p.m. GMT, and people in Iceland can look forward to seeing about 35% of the sun covered at sunset. Also, any North Alaskan listeners will be able to see a small chunk taken out of the sun by the moon at about midday. This is the first in a pretty busy month for eclipses, with one on June the 15th and another on July the 1st. More about them in next month's section. And that's it for the sky at night this month. Now back to Lauren and Maciek.
Thank you, Alex.
So, Lauren, I'd like to talk to you about the meaning of life.
As in the movie, or the real meaning of life?
Well, actually, life in this context stands for Living Interplanetary Flight Experiment.
Wow, what will that do?
Essentially, it's an initiative made by a non-governmental organization from the US, the Planetary Society. They want to send six species of microorganisms on that Phobos sample return mission we've just mentioned a while ago, and see how they will survive the few years' worth of journey to Mars and back, being exposed to all the cosmic radiation. Essentially, the goal of that is to test the theory of panspermia, test the theory that life could have moved between the planets, sort of piggybacking on a meteor.
So will these microbes be given any, food or nutrients that they need, or is this just put them in the capsule and send them off?
I think it's actually going to be very, very limited nutrients to see how well they survive. And the selection is quite interesting because they have your very average bacteria as well as some of the most resilient ones. So they're launching, one of the species they're using is the arsenic using bacteria from Lake Mono. Another one is cutely referred to as Conundibacterium. It's apparently a fairly common nickname for this strain of bacteria, which can withhold quite substantial amounts of radiation, actually. So if, say, 10 grays of radiation will kill an average human being, if those organisms can withhold up to 5,000... without significant damage.
And 15. So these small microbes are far more resilient to radiation than we are. 500 times more resilient.
It is the most radiation-resistant living form we know of. In fact, if you expose them to 15,000, one in three will still survive it. So just the weaker ones will die off.
Wow.
And it is quite an exciting experiment. And the reason why we are talking about this now instead of in November is because to test their technology, to test the containment cells, just to double check everything's in order, a copy of this experiment will fly on the next Endeavour shuttle mission.
Oh, okay. Very interesting.
They want to have something to compare it to and see how they how the organs respond to low Earth orbit conditions. I mean, say, if something dies off after a week on board the space shuttle, there's little point of sending it over to Mars because that they just won't make it.
Right. Well, once these organisms get to Mars, how will we know if they're still alive?
We won't. We will wait till they get back to Earth because, as I've said, it's a Russian sample return mission. So the aim is to get some of the material off Phobos and send it back to Earth. And together with that sample return package, the microorganisms are going to be sent back to space. I mean, it's very, given how small they are, you don't need a lot of them. It's going to be a very small payload.
Is there any risk that these microbes will contaminate the sample coming back from Phobos or even contaminate Phobos itself?
The risk is considered to be very, very negligible. Basically, they are going to be encased in very strong containers, and that is also part of the purpose of the of running it on the space shuttle, just to double check the technology is resistant enough to work well throughout the launch procedure and things like that, just to be extra safe about, as you've said, about the contamination issues.
That sounds wonderful.
Right, and I think it's time for the Astro Joke of the Month with Michelle.
Hi, Lauren.
Hi, Michelle.
Ready for another fantastic Astro Joke of the Month?
Yeah, I hear you've got a longer one this month.
I have indeed. It will be quite epic.
All right.
Okay, drum roll, please. A flying saucer is running low on fuel, so it sets down at a nearby petrol station. The attendant is very surprised to see this vehicle, obviously, and even more surprised to see UFO emblazoned on the side of the craft. But his curiosity gets the better of him, and so he asks, "Does UFO stand for Unidentified Flying Object?" And the otherworldly traveller replies, "No, it stands for Unleaded Fuel Only."
Thank you very much, Michelle. And that's it for this month. Make sure you tune in next month, guys.
Goodbye.
Goodbye.